Have you ever made a fool of yourself for someone or something that you love? Have you ever been willing to make a fool of yourself for someone or something that you love? So something, that's pretty easy. Anyone who's a sports fan? All right. And any face painters in here? Has anyone ever painted their face for a sporting event in their life? All right, there's a few that are willing to admit. Good, we're off to a great start. We're already humbling ourselves and being willing to admit some things that we've done. It's amazing. I remember there's this one distinct moment that'll always stand out to me in sports as a moment where, you know, New York City, those of you gone to like Madison Square Garden, if you've ever been to like a Knicks game or things like that, that's an expensive ticket, especially back in the early 90s when the Knicks were good. Back in the day, you know, when they were giving the Bulls a run for their money and the Pacers and all that stuff. And I remember watching on TV, I wasn't at this game, unfortunately, but I remember watching on TV, the Knicks were down 3 points with just a few seconds left, and they worked the ball around, and it ended up in the hands of my distant cousin, Larry Johnson, and he got the ball in his hands, and he's dribbling around, he's looking for space, and he just steps back, and he knocks down a 3-pointer and gets fouled. By Antonio Davis, if I'm not mistaken. But anyway, he gets fouled. And this crowd of executives, you know, especially that lower bowl where the courtside seats are, even back in the early 90s, are $1,500 a seat. They're down there. And what you saw, they did this amazing shot in Madison Square Garden. I think it was on NBC. And they pulled back and they showed the whole arena. And as soon as he hit the shot, as soon as it went in, the entire stadium just went, wow. Every arm was raised. And it was just this shriek, where grown men acted like little boys, and just people were dancing on the court. I remember being at a game once when something similar happened with Patrick Ewing. I remember looking down being like, is that Tom Brokaw? And Tom Brokaw was on the court in a full suit after doing the nightly news dancing because the Knicks, I'm like, there couldn't be a more distinguished guy in my mind. And he was out there doing, I don't know if it was the Macarena or one of those, or it was Rock and Roll Part 2 by Gary Glitter. You know that, da-na-na-na-na-na-na. Hey. Okay, great. Don't join me. That was terrible. But have you ever made a fool out of yourself for someone or something that you love? So I thought of the sports thing right out of the gates. Some of you with school spirit, maybe, Spirit Week, you're that one that really goes overboard and really gets into it. And that's you, maybe. Your Facebook posts are something that you're going to look back on someday with a certain level of regret. And those are public, a lot of them, so just remember that. Maybe at VBS, you know, maybe you were a leader or something at VBS, and you were just up on the stage, and you were leading, and you're like, you're making an absolute fool of yourself, but you didn't care because you were excited to do it. Or maybe it was for someone that you love. Maybe you've got a very elaborate proposal story to tell that involved restaurants and waiters and waitresses and roses and malls and flash mobs or whatever it was where you're just involving this entire world of people and you would never do anything like that before, but you did it. Why? You're willing to make a fool out of yourself because of how much you loved that person. You didn't care who knew it. I remember when I first started dating Angela, my wife Angela, my friends had been around me when I had kind of been involved in other relationships in the past. And I was kind of someone who was just very, public displays of affection weren't really my deal. I was just kind of played it cool, you know, in public. And even that word, public display of affection, it just, even there, it's like, man, that's just, there's just a lot of pressure. You know, a lot of people are watching and judging. But when we started dating, I mean, she just wanted to always be holding my hand. I don't know what it was. She just could not keep her hands off me in a very pure way. But I remember my friends rolling their eyes, you know, as we would be kind of snuggling, like while we're bowling, and she'd come sit down and be like, yay, we're just very schmoopy and very just, I don't know, very, very lovey-dovey. And they're like, what happened to you? I'm like, I think I might have actually found the one because I really don't care what you or anyone else thinks. All I care about is what she thinks. Have you ever made a fool out of yourself or someone or something that you love? Public displays of affection. When you reach that point where you say, I don't really care what anyone else thinks, that's a pretty bold statement, isn't it? You're valuing the opinion of the person you're doing it for or the team that you're doing it for. And, you know, it's always a little awkward when you're I know a few years ago we had an event where we did like a costume party. And yes, I say costume and not costume. I know that. My wife always points out that I mispronounce costume, but that's okay. And I dressed, we kind of got really into it with our group. And I came as the Mad Hatter. Like the Johnny Depp one, the really creepy, trippy one with like makeup and this big hat. And there's pictures somewhere on Facebook. Don't find it, but that's okay. But I remember, you know, when you're at the event, it's awesome. You know, everyone's dressed that way. But when we stopped for ice cream on the way home, I was the only one dressed that way in that ice cream parlor. And I'm pretty sure I scarred some small children because I didn't really acknowledge it. I didn't be like, hey, it's just a normal guy. I just kind of stood there in character, you know, kind of creepy-eyed and just, you know, it's a little bit embarrassing, but you know, I didn't really care what they thought because I was going all in with our event. It's interesting because David, in 2 Samuel chapter 6, David reached this point in his walk with God. If you remember the story, so David, you know, David had a long journey from when he was first anointed the future king of Israel by Samuel in front of all of his brothers. He had about a 14 to 15 year journey from that moment until he was actually crowned king of a unified Israel. And it wasn't just a journey where he was preparing under the tutelage of someone, and it wasn't just a journey that was pain-free. I mean, he was being chased around. He was being hunted, literally. He was hiding in caves. He was growing beards and pretending to be insane and hiding in different countries. I mean, it was quite a period in his life. If you didn't know that about David, it's great stuff if you go back and read through his life. But God was preparing him for something. And so David, in this story we're going to look at here, David reaches a point where he's excited. He gets 30,000 of his men together and they go to retrieve the ark that was lost to the Philistines. And they go and they get the ark and they put the ark on a cart and they're bringing the cart down the road. It's being pulled by some oxen. As it's going down the road, if you remember this story, it kind of hits some rocks and it gets bumpy, and a man by the name of Uzzah goes to catch the ark. And if you remember what the Ark of the Covenant was, this was literally sort of the symbol of the presence of God himself. And there were sacred items inside of it. And it sat in the Holy of Holies. This is a big deal. This is a very holy piece of furniture. Very holy. And so when it hit this bumpy road, Uzzah, which means the strength of man in Hebrew, ironically enough, he goes to catch it and help this thing and not allow it to touch the ground. What happened to Uzzah when he did that? He died immediately. He was struck dead. I remember as a little boy hearing that story and being like, I do not understand it. Why in the world? He was just trying to help. He didn't want it to hit the ground and smash. What's amazing is you've got to take a step back and understand that it wasn't just Uzzah's action that God was frowning upon. It was the entire way they were transporting the ark. Because in the book of Leviticus, very specific instructions are given as to how to transport the ark. It had rings on the outside of it, and Levite priests were supposed to put the ark on poles and carry it, and every 6 steps that they walked, they were to stop, set it down, and sacrifice a bull to the Lord, and then pick it back up and walk 6 more steps, set it down. That's going to be a long journey, isn't it? That's going to take a while. Every 6 steps. But that was what was clearly taught in the law, but David was in violation of this. David, they were just moving it on a cart, so already they were transporting it in an incorrect way. So they were already disobeying God, and so when this thing went to fall, Uzzah touching it was just sort of the symptom of a much deeper disobedience. It just showed that they weren't really paying attention to the specific rules that God had put in place to transport this holy item. And so David was upset. He was angry at the Lord for allowing this to happen. He was confused. And so they just kind of stopped where they were and put it at this house. And for 3 months, the Ark of the Covenant dwelled at this house. And everyone in the house was blessed and prospered. And great things were happening at this house where the presence of the Lord was dwelling. And so what happened? What happened next is pretty amazing. It is found in 2 Samuel 6, verse 12. So David goes and gets the ark back, and this time they put it on the poles and the priests walk with it and stop every 6 steps. So verse 12, and it was told to King David, the Lord has blessed the household of Obed-Edom and all that belongs to him because of the ark of God. So David went and brought up the ark of God from the house of Obed-Edom to the city of David with rejoicing. And when those who bore the ark of the Lord had gone 6 steps, he sacrificed an ox and a fattened animal. And David danced before the Lord with all his might. And David was wearing a linen ephod. So David and all the house of Israel brought up the ark of the Lord with shouting and with the sound of the horn. This was not a quiet arrival. I don't know how many of you in this room are closet dancers on the side. You know, we haven't really given you much opportunity to showcase your skills here. So I don't know that answer, but I do know that there's a way to dance where you just kind of got the little side to side thing, and this is my zone right here. And I did a lot of weddings where we were before, and a lot of the weddings had dancing at the reception. And so I'd always try to time our departure as the pastor did the wedding right as that was starting to happen. I'd be like, all right, it's time for us to go because, you know, I just don't want to do that. It wasn't really a conviction. It was more just a lack of skill and not really wanting to be publicly humiliated. So my wife would try to pull me out there for one little couple's dance so I could do the slow sway. That was about it. But I can tell you one thing. I've never danced with all of my might. This is like just some of my might. And really, I'd rather not. I might dance. You know, never dancing with all my might, that's for sure. But to see someone dancing with all, have you ever seen someone on one of those shows? They're like spinning on their heads and they're doing all this weird grabs and jumps and you're like, I didn't even realize any of that was possible. They're dancing with everything. They're sweating and they're going for it and they're swinging around and you're like, how did this guy who was a talk show host who's like 60 years old suddenly doing like the cha-cha? You know, like it's amazing to see the transformation on some of these shows when they train and they prepare. David danced with all of his might. Everything he had, he didn't hold anything back. But it wasn't just what he was doing, it was what he was wearing. David was wearing what's called a linen ephod, which was the outfit of a priest. It was actually the undergarment that a priest would wear under his robes when they would be serving in the temple. And so these were very short skirts, would be the best, just kind of a piece of cloth that kind of went down, and I don't know exactly how far, but it was to the point where later we find out he was a little immodest in his dancing. As he was dancing with all of his might, wearing this bed shirt, I guess. I don't know. But on the shoulders, there were 6 jewels on each shoulder. 6 jewels on each side. You read about this in another part of the Bible. And there's 12 jewels then at the top, and it represented the 12 tribes of Israel. And so this was a priestly garment. Very intentionally, David is wearing a priestly outfit as he's dancing before the Lord, as the ark is returning to Jerusalem. Very symbolic, because what was he doing as he went in front of this ark? He was dancing, wearing a priestly outfit, literally bringing the presence of God back to Jerusalem after being gone for so long. And if you think about that, you think, well, what did a priest really do? What was his role? A priest represented the people and brought the people to God. So David's doing kind of this dual thing. He's literally dressing like a priest, which is bringing the people to God, but then he's functionally actually bringing God back to the people. So it's this king-priest activity that's a pretty powerful moment. So he's dancing in a priestly garment with all of his might. And there was shouting and there were horns. It was quite a scene. And every 6 steps, they stopped and sacrificed a bull and a fattened animal. This was not a short distance. Even if it was just from here to Struplers across the street, that's a lot of bulls that had to die. If you look back to Solomon, when they dedicated the temple, so many animals were sacrificed to the Lord because they wanted to worship God in extravagance, because they recognized everything that they had. Again, in that time, your livestock and your cattle, that was a symbol of your wealth. Everything they had, they recognized, had come from God, and so how could they not give back to him extravagantly? So David is dancing with all of his might. They're sacrificing bulls. They're shouting, and there is cheering, and there is music, and there is dancing, and there's celebration as he comes back into Jerusalem. But it's interesting what happens. As the ark of the Lord, verse 16, as the ark of the Lord came into the city of David, Michal, the daughter of Saul, looked out of the window and saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord, and she was so proud of him. Oh, wait, is that not what it says? And she despised him in her heart. So now, let's not forget, what was David's job at this point? King of all of Israel. This was her husband. Now, if you know a little bit about Michal, you'll know her dad was Saul, the king that was sort of replaced, not sort of, totally replaced by David. So this marriage maybe wasn't the greatest thing to begin with, but in this moment, she is not happy at all at how David was acting. She despised him in her heart. And they brought in the ark of the Lord and set it in its place inside the tent that David had pitched for it. And David offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before the Lord. And when David had finished offering the burnt offerings and the peace offerings, he blessed the people in the name of the Lord of hosts and distributed among all the people, the whole multitude of Israel, both men and women, a cake of bread, a portion of meat, and a cake of raisins to each one. Then all the people departed, each to his own house. And David returned to bless his own household. But Michal, the daughter of Saul, came out to meet David and said, "How the king of Israel honored himself today, uncovering himself today before the eyes of his servants, female servants, as one of the vulgar fellows shamelessly uncovers himself." And David said to Michal, "It was before the Lord who chose me above your father and above all his house to appoint me as prince over Israel, the people of the Lord. And I will make merry before the Lord. I will make myself yet more contemptible than this, and I will be abased in your eyes. But by the female servants of whom you have spoken, by them I shall be held in honor." And Michal, the daughter of Saul, had no child to the day of her death. So you see what happens here. David comes back from this great moment. Imagine the high that he was on. He had just brought the ark back in. He made sacrifices. He gave food to all the people. Everyone left. Everyone's excited. Boy, this is the moment we've been waiting for. Israel is back to being a power. God is back to where he's supposed to be with us. And David comes home to bless his household. And before he even has a chance to bless his own household, he's met outside by an angry, bitter wife who confronts him and takes what David did as being beautiful before the Lord. Something he did, he didn't care who was watching, even though he knew the whole nation was watching. He was setting an example of how to worship God with all of your might and all of your heart and not worrying about who's watching you. And she says, "Boy, you made a fool out of yourself. You look like a vulgar, disgusting fellow, flashing all of this, all the female servants." It's amazing how that can happen in our own lives, isn't it? Or maybe you have a breakthrough in your walk with God. You have a moment of freedom. You have something that maybe you've been just battling, and then you feel like there's a breakthrough and something happens, and maybe it is during a time of musical worship, or maybe it's during a time of incredible prayer, or maybe something happens on a missions trip, or maybe something happens when you're serving somewhere, or maybe something happens at your job, or maybe you step up as a leader in your family and you call something out, or maybe you just have a great breakthrough spiritually and you are like, "Yes, finally, I was able to do it. Yes, I was able to just honor God, and I know this pleased God." And you come home to tell your wife about it. You come home to tell your family about it, and they cut you off and cut you out at the knees. There's really no pain like that, is there? She knew exactly what to go after, reminding him that he was nothing. Remember who David was before he was king? He was a last-born son. His future was at best as a hireling, a shepherd for hire. He had no future at all. And she's sure to remind him that she is of royal blood and he's no king. No king would ever do that. You're not a king. You're nothing more than a vulgar fellow. You're nothing more than a hireling. You're nothing more than a guy who's just gonna just bounce around subsisting off low-level jobs. That's who you really are. You showed the nation who you really are. You're nothing. You're gross. You're not royal. You're not a king. Went right after his identity. And what does he say back? David said to Michal, "It was before the Lord who chose me above your father and all his house to appoint me as prince over Israel, the people of the Lord. And I will make merry before the Lord, and I will make myself even more contemptible or undignified than this. And I will be abased in your eyes. I love that. He's saying, it wasn't before you. It wasn't in front of you. This was done before the Lord. I didn't do this for your benefit. I did it for his benefit. And I will do even more than this. I will go even further. If God calls me to do something more, I will do it because it's for him. I'm done trying to please man. I'm done trying to please other people and do it their way. That's what your dad did. That's what he's saying here. Your dad tried to please man. If you look at Saul's kingdom, if you look at Saul's reign, what was his undoing? That he listened to the wisdom of man and ignored the commands of God. And David is saying, God chose me because I will follow him over the wisdom of man. So I will do even more than this. I'll go even further. I'll go even lower in your eyes. But those people that you think less of me, actually in their eyes, they're holding me in high esteem. They've got incredible respect for me because of what I did today. And then there's this little, very cryptic epitaph. And Michal, the daughter of Saul, had no child to the day of her death. That could be a reference to God closing her womb, or it could be a reference to David just sort of ignoring her for a long, long time after that. But this was tough to come back from. You know, she cut him out at the knees, and he returned the favor, and there was just a split from this point forward. So here's a picture. Here's a picture as we talk about worship today. Here's one example. One example of worship that reveals a lot. It reveals someone willing to humble themselves before God. Someone willing to worship with all of their might, to hold nothing back. And it also reveals something about not being concerned about who else was around or what they might think of what's happening. It's a powerful picture of having your eyes so focused on God, so focused on the object of your affection, that you literally don't care and you're not even really aware of who else is around you. You are so enamored with the one that you're pleasing, the one you're trying to worship. I love this definition of worship. Worship is the active response to the reality of God in our lives. Worship is the active response to the reality of God in our lives. True worship. Active response. It's interesting, too, when you think about worship. John Piper pointed this out a few years ago. I thought it was pretty profound. He talked about missions existing because true worship doesn't exist. He said, in heaven, worship will continue to exist and missions will not. You ever thought about that? The stuff that we do, this whole series, this resolve, spiritual growth, trying to grow to be more like Christ. When we are in heaven, we know that worship continues. We know that for all eternity, worship will continue before God. But we're no longer going to be sharing our faith with people who are in heaven, right? That doesn't make a whole lot of sense. We're no longer going to be going on missions trips in heaven. I need to go over to that east quadrant and go share with them, and that gold, you know, their gold is getting a little faded or something, you know, like, we're not doing mission trips in heaven. What we are going to do is worship God. So worship, if you think about it, worship is something we get to do now that we will get to do forever. Missions, it's done now, but it's not going to be done forever. It's amazing when you think about it. Suffering is something we go through now. It's not going to be gone through forever. There are things that will cease, things that will end, things that God allows us to go through to make us more like himself, but they will end the moment we're standing before Jesus in paradise. But worship will never end. It will never end. Now, what it looks like and how it plays out will look different. If you think about in Revelation chapter 4, in Revelation chapter 4, there's a picture of what John sees. If you remember, John, while on the island of Patmos, is exiled by the Emperor Domitian, and he's out there, and he sees this vision from the Lord about how just so many things, supernatural things, and I love reading John's language here, because he's seeing things he's never seen before. So he's like, you know, well, this kind of looks like a locust with the woman's hair, and this kind of looks like this type of, you know, he's just sitting there, how do you describe something you've never seen before? to people that are reading it. You just try and use language they're familiar with to equate it to what he's trying to comprehend. But he talks about coming into the throne room. And he talks about what he sees there. And he says in verse 8 of chapter 4, he says, "And the four living creatures, each of them with six wings, are full of eyes all around and within, and day and night they never cease to say, 'Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty, who was and is to come.' And whenever the living creatures give glory and honor and thanks to him who is seated on the throne, who lives forever and ever, the 24 elders fall down before him who is seated on the throne and worship him who lives forever and ever. And they cast their crowns before the throne saying, 'Worthy are you, our Lord, our God, to receive glory and honor and power, for you created all things, and by your will they existed and were created.'" Later we hear in chapter 5, and verse 6, they talk about, "And between the throne and the four living creatures and among the elders, I saw a lamb standing as though it had been slain, with seven horns and with seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God sent out into all the earth. And he went and took the scroll from the right hand of him who was seated on the throne. And when he had taken the scroll, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the lamb, each holding a harp and golden bowls full of incense, which are prayers of the saints. And they sang a new song, 'Worthy are you to take the scroll and to open its seals, for you were slain, and by your blood you ransomed people for God from every tribe and language and people and nation. And you have made them a kingdom and priests to our God, and they shall reign on the earth.' And I looked and I heard, and then I looked and I heard around the throne and the living creatures and the elders the voice of many angels, numbering myriads of myriads and thousands of thousands, saying with a loud voice, 'Worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power and wealth and wisdom and might and honor and blessing.' And I heard every creature in heaven and on earth and under the earth and in the sea and all that is in them saying, 'To him who sits on the throne and to the Lamb be blessing and honor and glory and might forever and ever.' And the four living creatures said, 'Amen.' And the elders fell down and worshiped." Do you see what this is describing? The angels are singing nonstop. The elders are praising God. All creatures are. All mankind, all the angels. This worship that we're able to enter into is something that's happened before we were alive and will happen a long time into eternity forever. It's a powerful picture. And what's amazing is, no matter how much we offer, no matter how many thousands upon thousands upon thousands of angels and angels and angels, it's still not enough to adequately describe what they are seeing. Remember what Isaiah does? Isaiah says, I saw the Lord high and lifted up. He describes the throne room. And what's his response when he sees it? He's just like, I'm a dead man. Woe is me. I'm undone. I'm a man of unclean lips, and I live among the people of unclean lips, and my eyes have seen the Holy One. And what's his response to the holiness of God? He is willing to go out and to go on mission. It's beautiful, because in many of these cases, you have them falling down, and the word for worship in the Old Testament means awe, like to bow down, to lay down. Have you ever had someone bow down before you, even in a mocking way? You know, like our little girls will say to us, sometimes we ask them to do something. Say, like, "Lily, can you go put this away?" "Yes, Your Majesty." I don't think it's sarcasm yet. Someday, I'm sure it will be. But if you've ever bowed down, you know, it's, number one, it's kind of uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable to do this, but what are you symbolizing if you're on your knees? Yeah. And what are you symbolizing if you are flat out on your face? Besides probably weird echo. Scott, sound guy, here we go.
Have you ever done this? Have you ever been straight out, flat out on the ground, face? First of all, you smell the carpet.
It's better than you would expect, actually. Am I aware of what's going on around me? Am I pretty vulnerable right now? Would you say that this is a position of pride or humility?
When you are in an Old Testament Hebrew worship stance, you are laying flat out.
Yeah.
and it's dirty and it's uncomfortable. But when we see something that is so much bigger than we are, when we see something that's so much holier than we are, how are we to respond other than to fall flat on our faces and say, I am nothing and you are everything. I am absolutely nothing. I'm nothing. That is that pose. You lay flat down, boy, a lot of bad things can happen to you in that moment. You know, you've got a whole group of people laying down like that. Imagine, do you remember when, remember the Daniel story with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? It said the whole group was laying down like that. Three guys standing like this, you're gonna kinda stand out. We're not doing that. You ever get in a group, everyone's doing it, you're kinda like, well, I'll just kinda get halfway down and maybe the people behind me will do the same and we can sort of scale up the bowing and not get flat down. But it said in that text, everyone was flat down before the image of gold. Except for those three, they stood. When you lay flat like that, that is a position of incredible humility. It's also a position of incredible awareness of who you are and who you're not. When we see God, when we stand before Him, it's going to be tough to stand. I don't know about you, but I don't envision myself doing a whole lot of standing. I know I can approach the throne of grace with confidence because of the blood of Jesus, but I'm telling you, when I see the holiness of God and I see Jesus, I see myself falling on the ground and maybe grabbing onto His feet. There was a song a few years ago that came out. It was so powerful. And see, I'm losing my own balance. God's wanting to put me flat again. And the song said, I can't bow low enough at the vision of you, my God. It's such a beautiful lyric. I can't reach high enough. I can't bow low enough. I can't sing loud enough. It's like when we are confronted with the holiness of God and who He is, our capacities aren't going to offer us enough to properly respond to who He is. In the New Testament, the Greek word for worship is the word proskuneo, which means kissing towards, blowing kisses. It's our, Louis Giglio said that worship is also our response to what we value the most. Because everyone is a worshiper. Everyone. I was at a concert a few days ago, and what I saw around me were people that were worshipers. The object of their worship wasn't the same object of my worship, as far as I knew. But I'm telling you, when that band came out, something happened in the crowd. Arms went out. Eyes were closed. It was just like the shout of exaltation happened. It was amazing. From a sports perspective, I was in Yankee Stadium in 1996, Game 6, Jimmy Key, he was lefty, against Greg Maddux, righty, Atlanta Braves. The Yankees were down 2-0, came all the way back. Game 6, the Yankees were up 3-2, and they won Game 6 of the World Series, and I was in the stadium. And by that, I mean I was in the far bleachers, but that's okay, I was there. All I know is when Charlie Hayes squeezed that final out in foul territory, the third baseline, the Yankees won the World Series for the first time in 18 years. I just threw my arms in the air like this, and then it was this bizarre sea of people where I was just like, and I looked over, and my friends were like 30 rows back, and I was in the middle of this massive group hug. Total strangers. Extremely inebriated. And very, very happy. And all I could say was, if there was ever a sneak peek snapshot of maybe some of the unity that's to come in heaven, I'm walking down the streets of the Bronx, New York, and I'm just high-fiving everybody I saw and hugging and not holding onto my wallet or anything like that. It was amazing, you know? And people were singing Yankee songs. I didn't even know there were Yankee songs. And it was like a worship service in the streets. Everyone worships something. Everyone values something enough to give their affections to it, to sacrifice for it, to spend their money on it, to take their time to do it, to get there, to drive long distances, to show their love to that thing. For me to stuff in a message about worship today that somehow does justice to this, we'd need to sit here for several hours, and nobody's willing to do that. Worship is our active response to the reality of God in our lives. It's eternal. Think of some other instances of worship in the Bible that were not musical. What about Abraham? Remember what God asked Abraham to do? You know the whole story about how Abraham finally has this, they finally have the son Isaac, the son of promise after disobeying with Hagar and going another route. Then all of a sudden Isaac is here and God tells him what? He says, take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and take him to the mountain I'm going to show you and sacrifice him there as a burnt offering to me. And what does Abraham say? I can tell you right now, if God told me to do that with one of my kids, I wouldn't get up early the next morning and grab Lily and be like, let's go. I'm sorry, I'm not in that place. But Abraham literally got up early the next day and set out with his son to go to the place God told him about. And on the way, what does Isaac say to him? Dad, where's the burnt offering? The Lord himself will provide the sacrifice, son. And then when Abraham turns to his servants, when he gets ready to go up the mountain, he says, we will go worship, says to them about he and Isaac. We will worship, and then we will come back to you. Hebrews later points to that and says, Abraham was so convinced that Isaac was the son of promise, that he had reasoned in his mind that God was going to raise Isaac from the dead. Why wouldn't that be possible? The God who opened the womb of a 90-some-year-old woman could also raise a dead son. So Abraham was so into it, he's like, you know what? I'm going to worship God, and if God asks me to take a knife and bind my son and lay him on an altar, then he's going to raise him back. I'm done doubting God. I'm not holding anything back. So he takes his most prized possession in the world. Can you imagine 120-some years old laying his beautiful boy that he loves so much and taking the knife back? And the text says that he pulled it back to kill him. And the angel had to shout, Abraham, Abraham, stop! It wasn't, I'm going to do this. I'm ready. I'm going to sharpen it a little more. Anytime, God, if you're going to stop me, I'm not messing around. This is it. I may stretch my shoulder a little bit, get my plunge down. Okay, here we go. Okay, I'm really going to do it now. You know, it wasn't that. It was, he pulled it back and he was coming down to kill him. He was not hesitating. And the angel had to hop in there and say, stop, stop, stop. No, no, no. Abraham, Abraham, when you say things two or three times fast, there's a level of urgency there. What does God say? Because you have not withheld from me your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love. Then he lays out all the promises that he has for him. And I love that Abraham called it worship. It's bigger than singing, right? What about Isaiah? He sees God, and his response to the holiness of God is, here am I, send me. When God says, who will go to them and who will go for us and who will preach to these people? I'll go. He sees the holiness of God and his response is mission. Send me. I want to go. That was worship. Mission as worship, being willing to go. Now, one that's a little bit tough to explain, I think, is Job. That's a tough one. We know that Job had just about everything you could have. He was wealthy, he had a great family, he had reputation. Philip Yancey, in a book called The Bible Jesus Read, said it really poetically. He said that in the beginning chapters of Job, God pulls back the cosmic curtain and shows us what really is going on. When it says that Satan presented himself before the Lord with all the angels. And God says to him, hey, have you considered my servant Job? I mean, seriously. You could sit on that for like a year. God is offering up a righteous man. Say, hey, have you thought about testing him? He's awesome. Job is great. Satan, do you want him? That gives me some shudders. I don't know about you guys, but it's like, whoa, God, come on, man. Like, protect us. But then it comes back around with Peter. Remember with Jesus? Hey, Satan's asked for you to sift you as wheat. But I've prayed for you, Peter, that you'll return. That when you come back, your faith won't fail and you'll strengthen the brother. So again, there's this principle that when Satan asks for somebody, there you go. But God puts limits on him, right? He won't allow him to just destroy his life. He won't allow him to kill him. But boy, he allows him to steal, kill, and destroy, doesn't he? He allows him to steal all of his wealth. Can you imagine being there when all these servants are coming back? All these messages. Job is just hanging out in an afternoon. All of your barns are burned up. All your livestock is gone. Your children are all gone. They're dead. Everything you had is taken from you, Job. It's powerful what Job's response is. Job proves that we can worship God even in our suffering. How would I respond? Job arose after hearing that his children are gone, all of his money is gone, all of his animals are gone, all of his property, barns, everything's destroyed and taken. Weather, Chaldeans, just horrific events. Job 1:20 says, "Then Job arose, tore his robe, shaved his head, and fell on the ground and worshiped God." So he tore his robe to signify his grief. He shaved his head to signify the loss of his personal glory. Shaved it all bald, right off. And when it says he fell on the ground, flat out, and he worshiped God. And he said, Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And all this Job did not sin or charge God with wrong. That's intense right there. He finds out everything that he held precious is gone. And he falls on the ground, and he says, "Blessed be the name of the Lord." What does Job reveal in the suffering of that moment, in his response, in his active response to the reality of God in his life? What he revealed was he had lost everything of value except the thing of most value. He revealed that the thing that he valued the most in his entire life was not his stuff, was not his family, although that's hard to imagine. It was not his stuff, it was not his family, it was not his name or his prestige or his reputation. The thing that he valued the highest was his relationship with God. And that could never, ever be touched. That could never be taken from him, nor can it ever be taken from us. So he falls on the ground and says, "Listen, I came into this world naked, and I'm going to leave that way. Everything I have, in other words, is from God. He gives and he takes away. He gave me all the stuff. He's choosing to take it back. I'm not going to curse him. I'm going to bless him for his goodness. I'm going to bless him for who he is." And he falls on the ground and he worships God. His response to suffering was a humble act of worship, revealing what he valued the most. These are different types of ways to worship. There's so many other passages that talk about true act of worship being the renewal of your mind, and so many different passages like that. So worship, there's a verse that kind of goes overarching over the big idea of worship being an active response to the reality of God in our lives, being 1 Corinthians 10:31, "And whatever you do, whether you eat or drink, do it all to the glory of God." It's that picture that anything that we do, anything we do, whether it's the truck that you drive, or the clock that you punch, or the customers you wait on, or the patients that you visit, or the children that you're raising, or the wife that you're loving, or the husband you're submitting to, or the parents you're obeying, or the friends you're trying to serve, or the life you're trying to live, or the studies that you're doing, all of that can be done as an act of worship to God. All of it. Worship is bigger than singing, but it also involves singing. We try and say that every week. We worship God through our conversations and deepening relationships. We worship God through our time in the Word. We worship God in our tithes and our offerings and our giving. And of course, we worship God as well through our singing. Through our singing. In Psalm 134, it's interesting. There's these 15 psalms in a row called the Songs of Ascent. And the idea is, as people would climb these, there's a stairwell between the court of the women and then the main inner courts of the temple in Jerusalem. There were 15 stairs. And as they went up a stair, they would sing one of these songs from Psalm 120 to Psalm 134. And they would sing these out for each step that they would climb. And each step would be another song, and each step would be another song. And remember, devout Jewish pilgrims from around the world would try to get back to Jerusalem 3 times a year for 3 major feasts. And so when they would do that, they would practice this actively. And I love Psalm 134, 1 through 3, because it is the last of the songs of ascent, which means this was the top step before they stepped into the inner courts. So this was what this psalm is telling them to do is what they would be doing as they entered the inner courts. So Psalm 134 says, "Come, bless the Lord, all you servants of the Lord who stand by night in the house of the Lord. Lift up your hands to the holy place and bless the Lord. May the Lord bless you from Zion, he who made heaven and earth." I love verse 2. Lift up your hands to the holy place, and other translations say, lift up your hands to the holy place and worship the Lord. So here they are on the top step. And if they're singing this out, they're acting this out, they're entering the holy place of the Lord with their hands raised. And this picture in this time meant that even though we're standing on earth, we're reaching our hands to reach out and bless God in His sanctuary where He dwells in the heavens. Saying, even though my feet are firmly planted on earth, my hands are pointing to the heavens, pointing to something that you cannot see but you believe is there. It says, lift up your hands to the sanctuary and worship or bless the Lord. And I love that idea for worship then, is that picture for bowing. Remember in the Old Testament, the Hebrew would be bowing. So as your hands are raised, pointing to God, our response to God in His sanctuary is to bow down and worship. It's very much a posture that reveals so much. That because of God's greatness, our response is incredible humility and gratefulness. So they'd be walking into the court, singing this song with their arms raised high as they walk in. What a beautiful picture that would be. Now I have a bit of a confession to make when it comes to practicing this. That growing up, that wasn't my background, to raise my hands during worship, musical worship. I remember even going through college and even post-college a little bit, I wasn't comfortable with that. I felt like it aligned me with a different group that I wasn't agreeing with theologically. I felt somehow like they had hijacked this, like somehow they had taken Psalm 134 and pulled it out and that was theirs now. And so I remember God was working on my heart, because for me it wasn't that I didn't believe this to be true. For me, what was really revealed to me was that it was my own personal pride. Because it was humbling for me when I'd be in a time of worship and I would feel that impression upon my heart to raise a hand or to raise both hands and to shut my eyes and to engage with the supernatural, to engage with the one, to sing holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty, and to not be doing this as I sing and watching everyone around me being completely distracted by all of this, instead to focus on who was around me. Instead of being Michael and watching everyone and judging them, I needed to be more like David and completely enamored with the object of my worship, not the witnesses of my worship. And so for me personally, it became a pride thing. It became something where I was really fighting against it. And then I was at a conference in Atlanta probably 12 years ago now. And I remember the worship leader was just playing, and it was a powerful moment, and we were there with probably 5,000 college students. It was just an incredible moment. And I remember just standing there, and it was like my hands felt like there were giant boulders on the ends of them. I was just kind of like, nope, it's not happening. Nope. And I'd even be like, I'm not doing it. And then I would even kind of, just kind of close my eyes and put my head down, just kind of look real spiritual. But inside there was this war going on. And it was bizarre, because you know what? To anyone else, they would have no idea what was going on inside of me. This crazy battle. And I think it was, if I'm not mistaken, the song, "Give Us Clean Hands, Give Us Pure Hearts," written by Chris Tomlin and those Passion Boys a few years ago. And something happened in the middle of the song where I just let go of what everyone around me would have thought, of what the leaders who were with me would have thought, and I just decided in that moment to worship God in what I felt was an undignified kind of a way. And so I did this. The hand is here, keeping everything down, you know, so that's good. Still sort of under control, but yet one, and for some reason I always kind of do the L. I don't know if that's like Lord or something. It's just kind of the one finger. I don't know if this is the sports in me, but just the one hand went up. And I mean, I just felt like sweat dripping down my face as I felt like, okay, I've crossed over to some new world. And now there's no going back. Now I'm going to get fired from the church I'm at. And, you know, all my friends are going to stop talking to me. And, but what's amazing is once that all fell away, which took about 3 seconds, and I just let go of all the Michaels that were watching me, and I focused on God. I didn't even think about this anymore. In fact, it didn't even dawn on me that suddenly I was doing this. And then all of a sudden I was doing this, and I was doing this, and I was suddenly down on the ground like this, and I was just crying because I broke through to this new level with God where I no longer cared what anyone thought except for Him. I no longer cared what anyone who was watching me would think of me or how they would attend to the church I was at or the ministry I was a part of. All I cared about was worshiping God in freedom and in truth and being obedient to what He was asking me to do in that moment. And I'm telling you, the shackles came off and I just felt free. And what's strange is it actually opened the door to freedom in my life in so many other ways. Where I no longer was following God for the approval of man or cared about the opinions of those around me. I now was more enamored with worshiping God and with serving God for His approval and His affirmation. Because I'm telling you, in ministry we are so captive to encouragement. We're so captive to affirmation. We get done pouring our lives out in front of you. And if we don't hear something back, we're in trouble. And yet God in that moment showed me that all of this for me is an act of worship to Him. My preaching is an act of worship to Him. I can't save anyone's soul. That's the Spirit of God who does that. All I do is lay the word out before with the best of my ability and to the best way I can through my craft of preaching. And God does the work. God is going to set a heart free. I cannot set a heart free. God is going to heal your heart. I can't heal your heart. The Holy Spirit is going to usher you to a new level of intimacy and obedience and humility with Him. I can't do that. All I can do is continue to worship God with my eyes firmly affixed on Him and no longer worried about all the Michaels that are watching me. Worship is the eternal active response to the reality of God in our lives. I pray that we can worship Him today in freedom and in spirit and in truth. We're going to have our band come up here right now. And we're going to sing a song, Cornerstone. And what I love about what I do for a living is that I don't have to sell you a product. I don't have to point to something that may or may not function. I get to point you to a God that's bigger than anything you can imagine, that's greater than anything you could see. What I love is what Paul said. Remember what Paul said? Paul said, no eye has seen and no ear has heard and no mind can even conceive of what God has prepared for those who love Him. So in my opinion, when you worship God and you're giving it up, there's nothing that I could say that's going to oversell God. If anything, I'm doing a very poor job of explaining to a God that is so big and so holy and so worthy to lay your life at His feet, to lay your pride at His feet, to lay your woundings at His feet, to lay everything at His feet. I'm underselling. I'm doing a very poor job of truly explaining to you who God is. So this is the moment where the Spirit of God is going to usher you into a place where you have a clearer picture of who God is. And that's my prayer for you today, that you would not think about the Michaels in your life, the people that would judge you, but that you would seek to worship God in humility, in your suffering, in sacrifice, in mission, And even now as we sing together, that you would just hold nothing back. That if you truly love him, you would give back to him everything he's given to you. And it's beautiful when it's a family. And we are a family. If you're visiting here, we're just a big family. And our arms are open wide for more. We're that family that has the big dinner table and there's lots of laughter and fun and great food, but there's always an extra seat for you. And there's always an extra seat for that person that you're inviting. There's always a seat across from them for the person that they bring. Because we don't believe in institutions here, we believe in movements. And when the Holy Spirit of God moves our hearts to truly worship him, there's going to be no containing what God does in this area. Will you pray with me now as we sing to him about Jesus Christ being our cornerstone? God, we love you so much. We lay our lives at your feet. We offer back to you what you've given to us, which is everything. And so God, I pray that we would be free. I pray that you would set us free from whatever has always held us back. God, that we would worship you in humility. We'd worship you in sacrifice. We'd worship you in mission. We'd worship you in freedom. God, we want to be a people that please you with how we sing to you, with how we give to you, with how we worship you in our lives. I pray, God, that you would smile upon us and that our praises would fill your throne room even now with an incredible fragrance. And that such passion would break out of this room, that there be angels and others that would be tuning into this station and watching what's happening in here, God. We know we have your attention. We know that you are here with us. We know that you're everywhere. And I pray, God, that you would be so pleased with your children giving back to you out of the overflow of love that you've given to us. It's in the precious name of Jesus that we worship you.